Welcome to the Practice Podcast, conversations probing the nature of practice. I'm your host, Dave Fearon. This is a conversation with Tom Casey. Tom is a consultant who founded a very interesting firm, interesting, I think, to you as well as me, because of their focus on transitioning leaders, senior leaders, as well as taking a very systematic look at the challenges that leaders now face through and who knows how long beyond the COVID era. One of the concepts that really popped out to me and hopefully will to you is that businesses must become educational, not just have training and development and coaching, which is fairly usual, but that the whole enterprise needs to be reconceptualized as a place within which anyone who's working there will be able to continually learn and grow their practices on behalf of the total learning capacity of the company. I like that idea, and hopefully you do too. And you'll also hear about Tom's new books and lots of other surprising moments that we have in this conversation. So here is consultant, practitioner, Tom Casey. Well, this is going to be a very interesting conversation. I know even before we start, because I've known Tom Casey, well, maybe 15 years through our shared association in caring for the Duran Institute and the wonderful people who've worked in that organization over the years. Tom is a consultant to the Institute and me as a board member. But we reconnected around what Tom is doing right now, which I think will be extraordinarily interesting, given the times, the COVID era, and his focus in his company on particularly upper level people who've had a lot of success in leading companies in fairly conventional times, and who now are going through the same sorts of changes we are. And I think that's going to be a real conditioner of how they practice in the future. So Tom, first introduce your title in your company. So sure. I know I won't get it right.
Okay. I'm the managing principal for Discussion Partner Collaborative. I founded the firm 2007, and we have about 200 affiliated advisors worldwide. Now, what makes it a little bit unusual, David, and it fits into your issue here of practice, you would think with age comes wisdom, which we thought. I'm not sure that isn't being challenged, but the threshold for carrying the business card Discussion Partners is the advisor has to be over the age of 55. Mm-hmm. He or she has to come from one of four consulting firms where they were at the partner level. Everybody has to be living outside the States or have 10 years expatriate assignments. And our logic there is we Americans, you and I, David, you know, our definition of multinational is liking Mexican food. But when you're dealing,
I have to admit, I'm not very international in my experience.
Well, unfortunately, at the level that we're coaching and working with executives, they kind of expect us to know, you know, which fork to use and, frankly, which side of the road to drive on. The other thing that makes us unique is we do a lot of research on our own and we do a lot of writing. And that, I think, is the core. That's probably the core differentiation for how we practice, because it reassures our client base that we're trying to stay ahead of whatever the trends will be.
Yeah, I began to picture as you were saying a group of listeners as right. well as speakers who are tuned in so many different ways, that the input, the learning that they're achieving through their conversations with their clients and others and with each other mm-hmm. brings in a very, very rare kind of perspective, I guess, a gestalt on the world of least U.S. enterprise, and in particular, how people are leading those enterprise. Now, am I overblowing that, or
no?
Or you
no,
in the middle of a wonderful feedback loop.
No, I think that you know, if you challenge your own assumptions, which we do, okay, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that and I'm sure that you've experienced this yourself in advisory and board positions is, I'm always asking the question, why listen to me? You know, what is it about my background? What is it about? I mean, if I don't do that and realize that, you know, style will only get you so far, there better be substance there, then I'm out of business. Okay. And my company's out of business. So the way that we focus and internalize the situation associated with practice is we're relentlessly asking ourselves the question, what is it about us and what is it about our point of view that anybody would be willing to pay money to listen to? Okay, a very basic concept.
Basic, but it's the right question to ask. And it was all the years that I watched you working your wonders, you know, mm-hmm. consulting with our friends in Duran. Mm-hmm. And I actually heard you ask that question fairly regularly. And when sure. we do have our get-togethers and our retreats, and mm-hmm. it strikes me now that I, as a teacher, mm-hmm. a non-recovering teacher, always a teacher, should mm-hmm. be asking the same question as would most people whose role with others is right. to stimulate their learning and yeah. not just tell them what we know. On the other hand, if we don't know much to tell them, why would they spend money on it? So it's kind of the theory practice mix that you are essentially dancing in. And how have you typically answered that question lately?
Well, we're still here. We're still successful. We had a best-selling book that came out in July that addressed pandemic-related matters. So we had been began doing right from the beginning of the pandemic research, focused on two areas. One is that what will future leaders need that is not available in the training that they're getting now? Mm-hmm. That was one question we posed. The other is, how will the whole leadership effectiveness model overall and the people within it in the most senior levels have to adapt in order to be successful? And we've been using the words, anything remotely close to normal won't be until 2022. So we're working backwards from January 2022 and asking and answering the questions and constantly using pulse surveys to solicit input from people in terms of trying to address that question. So if I transition that into practice, okay, let's take the younger leaders right now, the people that you were teaching at CCSU mm-hmm. and business school and undergraduates. Mm-hmm. We believe, and it's one of the reasons I think the book found its audience, we take the view very, very strongly that unless the leadership development programs that you have promote empathy, transparency, collaboration, and accountability, then you don't have a program. All right, that's our going in proposition. And the very first thing you need to ask and answer the question, if you're running these types of programs, whether you're a human capital person or a CEO or responsible for learning in your organization, is, have you been developing the right people all along? Yeah. And that's a painful exercise, because oftentimes the future leaders, and I go right back to, you know, the GE model that, you know, I went to school on when I began my consulting career. And, you know, it was all about performance.
Yeah.
All about performance. And, you know,
Performance or else, I think, was probably
performance or else. A book just came out about that exercise was, you know, called Lights Out. All right. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, the focus and the obsession about performance above all else translated into the demise of General Electric. As you know, Dave, the constant in my life is, you know, I'm now associated with the military for the better part of 50 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the part of the core thing, and, you know, particularly when you're in special ops, like I have been, is learn or die. that is essentially what happens, you know, constantly looking for the data that supports whatever decision you were making or, you know, think you may have to make in the future, or people can get hurt, including you.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. You know, so translating this into a practice, it's this constant, relentless self-examination, which in fairness, I find is translating into three different types of CEOs or C-suite executives. One is those people who are thinking like me, which is the ones we resonate with. Yeah. Those that are pretending to think like me. Okay, now that's an exhaustive process to try to say, well, you know, let's get real on this one. Or those who say they don't need it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll give you a case in point. Our salespeople had me traveling. This is pre-pandemic, actually a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a recreational vehicle company in California. And they was not doing well and had continued turnover at the top, high potentials, and also, frankly, longer serving executives. And flew out, met with the CEO, a meeting with the CEO who's wearing a blue short sleeve shirt, has glasses on that were so large that they had their own zip code. Okay. and a brush haircut. And I'm going through all of the things that, you know, were peer age, and said, look, you know, I didn't get it either, but I had to adapt to the attitudes of the new worker. I had to think ahead in terms of it's not just money, it's development, it's culture. Okay. It's a feeling of inclusion. I had to embrace the issue here of despite my blue state Massachusetts liberal tendencies, I don't know what it's like to be somebody of color, and I certainly don't know what it's like to be a woman. Mm-hmm. Man is sitting there, he's listening to me. His conclusion was, Tom, I understand, but I want people working here who look just like me. Ooh. And my first reaction.
That was a couple of years ago.
A couple of years ago. And exactly right. That was like, and it was all I could think about is maybe I can get an earlier flight. Okay. So, you know, the thing is that and there's extremely successful people who think I'm bananas, but I would also suggest that, you know, luck will only take you so far.
Yeah. And I think success is not forever. as we can see in professional sports and many other ways, it's almost like saying I have been successful.
Right.
But now we'll see. And right. At that we'll see moment is where I hear you've got an intro. But yeah. If they still think they're successful and they just need you to come in and baste the duck a little bit, I doubt that you would spend a lot of time.
They wouldn't. We're not the firm they would call. Okay. That they and as you know from our conversations, cases that I've tested and frankly picked your brain on, you know, what would you do, David, if you were me? The thing is that it's an issue here of, and I'll use a military metaphor, there never would have been a World War II if the French, after they built the Maginot Line, the Germans just got scared. You know, instead they just went around it. You know, his plan is military planning goes, that one needed a little work. Okay? And it didn't factor in air power. You translate that into a commercial issue is the biggest problem that you see is those people who don't learn from their mistakes and or continue to think that they will be successful just doing the same stuff.
Right.
And that has a sell-by date in my experience.
Right. Good way to put it. Let me jump back because I want to give you a plug for that book. What is the title of that book?
Leadership Development, The Next Curve to Flatten.
The Next Curve to Flatten,
right. And I, as recently as this morning, stunned and amazed that we knew we had won an award in Japan, which when you're being paid in yen, okay, this was a first for us This was my sixth book. I'd never been paid in yen before. I thought it was a joke. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden, royalty checks went into the account from this morning from Australia, Hong Kong, China. Okay. And I think that a lot of organizations and a lot of executives are asking the question, what is the pandemic telling us and what do we need to do differently? Which is why I think it's found its audience.
Yeah, I think it's not only it is the book of the moment, and it has that feedback you're already getting that people right. are saying leadership development must continue, but how? And you alluded to it briefly when you talked about undergraduate preparation and the human qualities that need to be there and developed in a constant way. And then the other thing is that there have been times when training and development have been looked at as nice to do if the budget allows.
Right.
How do you see that coming in positioning various forms of training and development, including coaching and other ways to help people help themselves get through the, you know, the fog? And you see that as about the same, less or more? Because if that curve is climbed, that means that there's something there that's going to be very important to every organization.
Yeah, my response when this type of question comes up is my response is somewhat hyperbolic. I say, well, just do the math. Okay, we baby, let's say, you know, we're in the United States. You know, you and I, there were 87 million of us born. The Generation Xers, the leaders that we're still working with, they were only 44. So the people that you're looking for the next generation of leadership to replace us, they were never born. So you better get working in terms of making sure that person who you've targeted as your successor is very, very well prepared, or your 401k won't last very long. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now it gets even more dynamic when you look at what is something that is, you know, with all of the discussions about the pandemic and the US election and the global economic crisis. I'm not surprised this hasn't come up, but there is another footnote to history here, which is as of December 2019, the baby boomers are no longer the biggest population anywhere, including in the United States. It's a combination of the millennials and the Generation Z, who were born approximately 2002. So that's the biggest customer base. It's the biggest voting block. It's the biggest block for influence. And frankly, we're not even thinking that coming right now. And we better get ready for it, because their attitudes, we've gone from pen and paper to internet to et cetera, et cetera. This is what I call the iPhone generation. They're not even talking to you, they're texting you. All right. And you know, you better buckle up, because that's what we're going to have to get used to. But you embed that into your practice. And think about it, David. Look at by just pathetic circumstances, we have had to figure out a way to work remotely.
All right. Absolutely.
It's a big
game changer.
It's huge. It's huge. And now what you're looking at, and we're working with clients that are actually seeing their productivity go up, their customer experience levels going up, and they're trying to come to grips and saying, do we ever really want to go back into an office?
Yeah. They're looking at the huge buildings that they've spent a ton on in their mortgage to the hilt to sustain. And I've thought of that as I've driven by Hartford, our local city, right. and see those great buildings. And I know the one that I had some involvement with, Travelers, is beautiful suites.
Right.
And I also have had a couple of recorded conversations with Travelers employees, former students, and they don't work there anymore, but they want to,
right.
but they probably won't. And there will be some kind of a split on that, I assume. You're the guy with the crystal ball on that. What do you think will be the trends now that we've experienced the productivity and other pluses that seem to go along with this kind of access to each other?
I think we need to embrace the horror and focus on three specific questions. Okay, and what are we going to do about it regardless whether you're in an NGO, a commercial sector, regardless whether you're family owned or global. One is, what is the attitude of your executives now in terms of what are they looking for post pandemic?
Okay. Oh, day of the year 2022.
Frankly, or January 2021. Okay, and what we're seeing, David, is that executives in their late 50s, early 60s, and frankly some younger, are essentially coming out of this life experience and saying, life is too short. Whatever I wanted to do as a passion, I'm going to do now. And so they're giving a heads up to their companies that they're either not coming back or they're not coming back for long.
Wow.
Okay.
That's surprising.
Yeah. And, you know, then it calls into the question, the whole succession planning and a whole bunch of commercial questions. We're also seeing that even those who are planning on coming back, okay, we call it the divisibility formula. They're essentially saying, all right, I was planning on working another 6 years. I'm dividing by two and I'm coming back for three, which again is calling into question, you know, where are the future leaders going to be?
Yeah.
And frankly, how well trained are they? All right.
Yeah.
So the model that I've been thinking and we've been discussing internally within our, you know, partner community is we take the view that regardless of the money, okay, you'd better get used to the idea that any company right now is in the education business and better figure out a way to develop its people somehow, or they're going to be less than competitive, assuming these people even stay.
That one makes my ears perk up. You can't see it because I'm wearing headset, but
I could see. I thought it was smoke, actually.
Something. But being a lifelong educator, as I hope to continue to be in this format, I had a really good response to that notion, Tom. I really do. I think that the holism of that notion that you and your colleagues have come up with is kind of thing that makes us stop separating out this function, that function, and people, you know, relegating them to the HR, you know, all of the stuff that you and I know about. And it says wherever one is in that system called whatever the company is, are they supported for the kind of learning they need to do? That means a lot of thought that is not there in the conventional management textbooks.
No, it's like getting ticket punched. Okay. You get your first degree, you go to work, you go back, you get your second degree, you go back to work. Okay. You go up the food chain of management and, you know, you're judged based on your performance and how well you deal with the opportunities that are in front of you. And that to me is the game changer. Number one, the people that we're talking about being the future leaders, they don't look anything like us. Okay. And now there's more of them. Second is most organizations focus on development and training in economic terms, not on survival terms, which I think they should need to change that mindset.
That's a really, really key point. I'm going to underline that one for the listeners. Okay. From a nice thing, compliance, those kind of reasons for training and development to survival.
You know, we're back to the military model here, learn or die. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the third issue here is we need to disaggregate our reward systems and focus less on the incentives, cash incentives, and as much on the opportunities for your best and brightest to learn. I mean, if you go overseas, David, and as an educator, you know that there are countries that they identify as a, you know, borderline toddler, who their smartest people are, and they pay for everything, putting them through school.
That's right.
And they become the intellectually elite, and they're the ones that are developed. And look at places like France now, and look at places like the UK. These people were singled out and identified, you know, frankly, in the crib as having potential. Macron's case, marrying the teacher, probably didn't hurt. But the same issue here, that's not how we think about it in the US. It's a dollars and cents. I mean, look at how we're judging success during the pandemic. How good is the stock? Frankly, I don't care what today's numbers are if I have to go to a wake.
You have a lovely way of summarizing things, Tom. I envy that. You pull it up short, and it puts the needle on the right track. Mm-hmm. We have wonderful coincidence. I'm telling you that we have very similar patterns of way of thinking about particularly leadership in organizations. And I will bring in Peter Vail at this moment and say that if were he here right now, he would be nodding. He wouldn't be interrupting you because he would be wanting to really listen to you. And I should be listening more than I am right now too. But I just finished rereading Managing as a Performing Art, which he wrote in 1989, where he where he based the entire book on his insight or foresight that we are going to be in permanent white water, mm-hmm. manager, managerial leader, any other mm-hmm. kind of practitioner. So make ready to be mm-hmm. wrong a lot and to become a beginner again a lot. And that was in 89. Mm-hmm. Well, now it's here. And Peter was probably saying he didn't even see the COVID piece. But now that COVID's happening, as things we've just discussed, this point of how people are going to be able to learn in a spontaneous and courageous way has never been more compelling.
Well, I have three reactions to this. One is in 89, we were about ready to go into a global recession. And I think Peter was giving people a heads up.
87 okay. was the beginning of
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then we were on the skids at that point. Yeah. Second thing is, you know, and this is one of the things that I believe that current leaders, future leaders really need to understand historical precedent. And looking at another crisis that preceded the 87-2 recession that Peter was writing about was the Great Depression. And mm-hmm. Roosevelt, one of the things that happened in one of Roosevelt's first meetings with his cabinet is he was wheeled into the room, okay, total chaos surrounding him, and he looked at his cabinet and goes, now what? You know, he didn't really arrive with a plan. And he essentially said, go back, try anything. If it works, keep doing it. If it doesn't work, try something else.
Pragmatism ruled.
Right. And I think that what Peter was saying and what Roosevelt is saying does two things. One is, at this particular point, the pandemic has changed all the rules. Mm-hmm. And there's a metaphor that we use, that there's a movie with Cher and Nicolas Cage called Moonstruck.
I love that movie.
Well, there's a scene in it that will resonate, which is Nicolas Cage is proposing to Cher, and it's his brother's fiance, and she slaps him across the face and says, snap out of it. And that's kind of the message we're giving the CEOs right now. If you're looking for a template to follow, forget it, because nobody has it. And by the way, as consultants, we would love to tell you we do, but we don't. So just start experimenting, et cetera.
But beginners again, and that takes a tremendous amount of humility, and hubris is going to get in the way of that, don't you think? Particularly
that goes back. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
These mainly men who have right. more my skin tone than most right. leaders, they have had it so not you easy, know. But they've had deference all these years, and they have been, the assumption has been that they're smart because they're in a strategic in the jet stream of a strategic think, all that, you know. But this is going to be hugely humbling for a lot of these people who want to stay on and figure out what to do next.
I think so, but I'm looking at it just a little differently. There's a lot of these folks that have been extraordinarily successful, and an element of their success has been they don't think of themselves as smart. Okay, they're always out there talking to people. They're always looking for more knowledge. I look at the gentleman that founded the Carlyle Group. Name escapes me in the moment, but you know, he was always out there looking to talk to people. Bill Gates, the same thing. A lot of extraordinary Jamie Dimon. A lot of these folks were constantly looking to chat with people, as was Alexander seeking Aristotle. But and it does point to something that I do perceive to be a flaw. One of the things that when we began our succession planning practice back in 2013, when we were working with the executives who were about to leave, and we were saying, you know, first line of defense for your legacy is make sure your successor's ready. We kept hearing, all right, well, they're not as strong as I am. Mm. All right, now, you know, you're originally getting, yes, the world as we know it will end when you go off. But then we started saying, well, what do you mean? And they came up with four things. One was, well, they're not particularly global. Now, if you go back to 2013 for the last 7 years, a lot of the executives who are now finding themselves in the C-suite, they grew up during recessions. They didn't have expatriate assignments. They didn't even do a lot of global travel. So they're not as global as they probably need to be. So they need to fix that. They can't write at all. you know, they, you know, I mean, you as an educator, I must go crazy because, you know, they get your, everything is trying to reduce to a dancing animal on a PowerPoint versus writing a paragraph in a white paper. Their definition of collaborative is to circle around electronically. And all three of those things, those are, if you really call the question and say, are they important? Yeah, of course, fix them. But the one that's more elusive, and we kept hearing this, is from these executives, very, very successful men and women. They kept saying that, well, the people that are coming up behind me, they're not as intellectually curious as I am. All right. And, you know, we originally, frankly, didn't understand what they were asking or suggesting. And what we realized is that this generation, they're not readers. They don't look at biographies. They don't look at history. They'll read business books. They'll read the Wall Street Journal. It's a headline and on their phone from the Atlantic and the Economist. But they're not reading a large biography on Wilson, Roosevelt, Churchill, and asking the question, okay, when these guys got in trouble, how did they get out of it? And you know, there's nobody who we study as leaders. Regardless of who or whatever our red state, blue state, Democrat, Republican, everybody we're looking at trying to figure out how did they do it. They were flawed human beings, mm-hmm. just like us. Mm-hmm. All right. So the thing is, but what did they do that makes sense? So yeah. if you adopt a practice that's essentially saying, all right, I want to become a voracious reader of biographies, you know, vaya con Dios, please go right ahead, because frankly, there's no way you won't benefit from that. Uh-huh. So think about what you said about the teaching. Mm-hmm. Okay, say an organization has no money. Okay, they develop. Pick five biographies, go to Amazon and give them to your high potentials and say there'll be a quiz later.
I like it. I do. I like it. We're moving toward our the old clock on the wall time, Tom. So, and this has been so rich that mm-hmm. I want to keep going, but I can't for this occasion, but I am now even more curious than ever mm-hmm. about how your own energies seem to flow up into every day. And you have so much energy okay. and so much curiosity and intellectual curiosity that, you know, there's going to be a Tom Casey secret to life here that I can glean before we end this recording.
My wife is Peruvian, so, you know, the steady stream of espressos is probably helping. You know, I think the espressos are probably they help you perk up a little bit. Okay, down in Peru they call American coffee dirty water. So you know, that's probably it. But you know, the other issue is this is just a thing that I say to my children and grandchildren: really have a good time trying to figure out how things work, how people think, why they feel the way they do, okay? And figure out for your own personal brand and your learning what you think is useful for you. And, you know, it's a constant journey. I mean, we were talking about development, and I know we're running out of time, but I want to leave you with this. Sure. I was a senior partner with PricewaterhouseCoopers, and every day I was leaving the place, and I would ask myself four questions. You know, what have I done to make sure my clients are happy? What have I done to get new clients? What am I done because they had partners reporting to me to make sure that all the partners are, you know, toeing the line with their clients? And what have I done to develop staff? And I realized the answer was number four, was virtually nothing. And I had a huge comeuppance on two levels. One, I'm literally flying in from someplace. I'm washing my hands in the mess room. There's a kid standing behind me. And it's even painful to recall, David. And I turn around and he holds out his hand. And he said, you know, he's introducing himself. And you go into the partner rep. Hey, how's it going? His name's Brian. I'll never forget the kid. Mm-hmm. And I said, how's it going? And he said, and, you know, what are you working on? And he gives me that. And I said, well, who do you report to? And he says, well, actually, I report to you. And wow. He was telling the truth, except that where he, you know, the definition of reporting was somewhat of a generous interpretation. However, it was important to him. And I had no idea who this kid was.
That is that's definitely an eye opener. Yeah, for someone as compassionate as you are, that had to hit you.
Well, PwC partners, we're not compassionate. That's how we get to be partners.
Notwithstanding.
But the way that I did it, recognizing that I was already troubled by lack of answer to number four, what am I doing to develop, mm-hmm. is we started a program at PwC is saying, take the juniors out. They are there. They do, you know, they watch, listen, and learn, mm-hmm. and ask them a lot of questions about what did they notice after. And if we don't have bazillions of dollars to throw them into training, and frankly, the training may not be all that good, mm-hmm. at least try to set good examples and make sure they understand why we did what we did.
That's terrific. That's a nice consequence. We can both thank Brian for that insight. And
it was the Brian model referred to. Yeah,
the Brian model.
He'll live in infamy.
Well, this has been Tom Casey. It is Tom Casey. It will be another time, I'm sure, because there's so much more to understand about practice. Tom, you put your finger on it. Just have something that you'll never figure out all the answers to. Right. That's why I put a question mark on this series. Practice, because having this conversation has been so unique, and I look forward to more of the same. And thank you again.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Practice Podcast, where we discuss practice with a capital P. If you'd like to hear more, listen in on Spotify, Podomatic, and Apple Podcasts, or go to inactionresearch.com/podcast-page. And if you'd like to learn more about social inaction and the nature of practice, head over to inactionresearch.com for more information. Thank you for supporting this show. We look forward to hearing from you soon.